Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest move by the Congress to enact unpopular giveaways to powerful corporations under the cover of the daily chaos created by the circus that Donald Trump's presidency has become, in which the ringleader distracts the press and the public as Congress enacts regressive changes that will damage the country and hurt Americans, in particular those who voted for Trump. We will look into Congress's repeal of internet privacy protection and speak with Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and the author of the new book just out, Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. He joins us to discuss yesterday's repeal allowing Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast to make money by selling private personal information about you in the $80 billion surveillance marketing business already dominated by Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Then we will speak with Charles Grant, a co-founder and director of the Center for European Reform in London, who previously covered the EU for The Economist. He joins us to discuss today's triggering of Article 50 that will begin the two-year Brexit process, which the UK's Prime Minister Theresa May said was an historic moment from which there can be no turning back. We will assess tensions around Angela Merkel's demand for a divorce first, then a settlement later, and the probability that Brexit will trigger a referendum on Scottish independence. Then finally, as the siege tightens on the ISIS strongholds of Mosul and Raqqa, we will look into the increase in civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, which have prompted the Pope to demand urgent action to protect civilians, and has Amnesty International concerned that the sharp increase in casualties is tied to the loosening of the rules of combat by the US-led coalition. Rayed Jarrah, the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee Office for Public Policy and Advocacy, joins us to discuss whether President Trump is fulfilling his campaign pledge to target ISIS more aggressively because Obama was, quote, too gentle with his air campaign. And joining us now is Jonathan Taplin, who's the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book just out is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you. And I wish it wasn't on a day where there's more bad news. Yesterday, the Congress repealed internet privacy protections, allowing phone providers to use personal information to sell highly targeted ads, making them rivals to Google and Facebook in this $80 billion online advertising market. In effect, what's happening here is they are entrenching what you refer to in your book as surveillance capitalism. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, this is a new movement in which the five largest companies in the world are all engaged in surveillance capitalism. I mean, that would be Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and to some extent Microsoft. But the real three that are doing the most to collect everything they can about you right now are Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And as you know, Google and Amazon have even deployed speakers in your home with microphones that are always on to listen into every conversation you have at home in order to try and find more ways to market to you. I mean, I think there is a battle between big tech and the citizens' right to privacy, and it's very clear that both the Congress and the White House and its counselor, Peter Thiel, who, of course, is a largest shareholder at Facebook, are going to side with the tech industry over the rights of citizens.
But Tom Wheeler, the former chair of the FCC, has an article, an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times, where he suggests that The circus atmosphere of this White House is the diversion of public attention away from many other activities undertaken by the Republican-controlled government. So is this what's happening here, that a huge tectonic shift is taking place that's going to further commodify people who have no value out of their own personhood? Is this going to go under the radar, in other words, because of Trump's daily scandals?
Well, look, I'm not sure. I see already today on Facebook and on Twitter some real pushback from citizens and public activist groups and everything against this outrageous thing. What should have happened was they should have cut back Google and Facebook and Amazon's ability to capture all your information without your permission, rather than instead, you know, turning on and letting Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast get into the game. And, you know, they kind of turned the whole idea on its head. What was needed was more control over your personal information. And after all, these companies don't care about content or anything else. All they care about is the data that they're collecting. I mean, content, whether it's news or music or movies, are just commodities to be used as bait to get to collect more data. And so in terms of the journalism business, as you have observed as well as anybody, you know, Facebook is the primary way that fake news gets dispersed. I mean, it's very clear to me that none of this fake news thing could have happened without Facebook and Google's advertising platform, because, you know, a kid in Macedonia could make $10,000 a week publishing fake news between using Facebook and a Google AdSense account. So none of this would have happened if these tech platforms hadn't been out there. And now what are we doing? We're just allowing it to get worse, because now my take is that the phone companies, now having asserted their ownership of this data, can now sell it to Google and Facebook, which they, you know, they will, as well as sell it to Amazon. And maybe they'll be somewhat competitive in this marketplace themselves. But really what they're going to do is use this to sell that data of where you went, where you were browsing, to the big data marketers, which are, as I've pointed out in the book, the largest corporations in the world.
And that is Google, Facebook, and Amazon. What order?
That's correct.
In what order?
Google first, Amazon second, Facebook third.
So let's talk about then citizen pushback, because I know people are outraged, and, you know, people were outraged when Brexit passed, but now it's a catastrophe and they're implementing it as we speak. So my sense is that the public aren't entirely aware of what's going on here and what you're referring to as the surveillance marketing business, because what's happened is that we as individuals, you and I, have become commodities. Other people make money out of us, but we don't make any money out of our own personhood, which I think if everybody recognized that basic fact, wouldn't they either demand a cut or say, wait a minute, I'm in charge of myself, not you?
Yeah, I think both those things could happen. First off, we think of this as just convenience, right? Okay, well, I'll surrender all this data because it's convenient for me to have access to Google and have access to Facebook. But first place, these are not cost-free services. First off, Facebook and Google charge a very large premium to advertisers because they're able to give them extraordinarily detailed data. If you wanted to reach women who drive trucks and drink bourbon in Nashville, Tennessee, these companies can do that. And that's because they've collected all this data and have segmented everybody into 200 different buckets of interest and levels. And so that thing gets much worse. think of what happens when you go searching for health problems, you know. Now, that data is now going to be served up to, and eventually that data could wind up back on your employment record in some way, because employers are more and more searching your social media history before they go on. And if they see that you've been looking for cancer cures or something like that, all of a sudden you might not be employable. So, I mean, this has a real cost. And somehow we've grown up in the last 10, 15 years thinking that privacy doesn't matter anymore. But my take on it is it does matter. And let's be clear, if we get into real political struggle here, there's no reason that someone who is not got a lot of scruples, like our current president, might not get this data in the same way that, you know, the NSA got some of this data 3 years ago, and use it against individuals for political activism or other things.
Well, there are rumors to that effect, that they're floating ideas of how to stop demonstrators, etc. But you mentioned something that's scary as hell, and that is the idea that these devices now in the home that Amazon and others sell have microphones that are turned on all the time. What are the rules with that? Because that's where, you know, people could be at their most intimate discussing stuff like, for example, you know, cancer diagnosis and whatever.
Right.
What is the firewall?
There
what
are no rules. That's the scary thing. The tech business is the most unregulated business in the history of the world, and this was set up for a very strong reason, as I pointed out, because the tech business was built by uber-libertarians like Peter Thiel and Larry Page, who's the head of Google. These people don't believe in privacy. They don't believe in copyright. They don't believe in taxes. How did Jeff Bezos build a business that destroyed 300,000 individual bookstores in America? Because he didn't have to pay taxes, and they did. So, I mean, these people have no desire to build a business that has any strictures. So you think about these things like the Amazon Echo. Today there is a case going on in Mississippi where the attorney general, a prosecutor is trying to get Amazon to turn over the records from the Echo because there was a domestic violence case that he believes was totally recorded on the Echo, you know, the whole incident. Now, Amazon is fighting that because they don't want people to understand that it isn't just the microphone gets turned on when you ask the Echo for some specific thing. The microphone is on all the time. And so that's the scary part. And you know, in Orwell's or Huxley's wildest imagination, you couldn't have thought that people would install willingly a microphone in their home for a large corporation to essentially take everything they say and use it as a marketing tool. I mean, that's why I call it surveillance capitalism. This is new. This has never existed before, and I don't believe that the regulators or anybody else have even thought about these things.
Well, this is a very activist agenda that the Republicans have and that the president has, and I mentioned earlier the former FCC head Tom Wheeler's article in Wednesday's New York Times, How the Republicans Sold Your Privacy to Internet Providers. And already, not only has this just happened Tuesday, but he also pointed out that earlier they have gotten rid of the idea of taking reasonable measures to protect confidential information on their customers, such as social security numbers and credit card
right.
information. And the idea that that stuff, which ends up in the hands of criminals, is no longer secure is just breathtaking. So it feels like the public are going to have to play catch-up here. Is that – what's your sense of the pushback?
I agree. If you think about, you know, some of the measures that the public have taken, for instance, to try and keep advertisers from advertising on Breitbart, that was a strictly bottom-up movement by citizens who said this is bull. you know, the public started this thing called Sleeping Giants, which essentially embarrassed advertisers to get them to not advertise on racist sites like Breitbart. That's beginnings of the kind of movements that need to happen. And, you know, just how this is going to be organized from a kind of bottom-up community way, I don't know. But I also know that individual states could make privacy laws that could override the federal this decision by the Congress. There's no reason that California couldn't pass its own laws in terms of anyone selling mobile services, Verizon or anybody else in California, had to protect the privacy of the user's data and their search logs.
So just
and that may be the only way this is going to happen, that Xavier Becerra or someone else like that, or Maury Healy in Massachusetts, says this is wrong and we're going to pass a law. If you want to sell mobile service in Massachusetts or California, you have to, you know, adhere to these rules. And that's what needs to happen, because clearly the Trump administration and the Republicans are in the thrall of these libertarians like the Koch brothers and Peter Thiel. And the strange thing is, this isn't liberty for humans, for citizens. It's liberty for corporations to do whatever they want to do.
Well, given the pattern of the Trump administration putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank at cabinet levels, where you have at EPA an anti-environmentalist, etc., is Ajit Pai the new head of the FCC? Is he one of those? Is he, in other words,
absolutely?
He's a libertarian,
absolutely,
and he's about to wreck the whole thing.
And the whole notion is that corporations should not have any rules or regulations on its behavior, and we'll see what happens.
Well,
but this is no different from what's happening at the EPA or anything else.
Yeah, but
it's essentially a crony capitalism on a level that we haven't seen since probably, you know, Calvin Coolidge.
But does this mean then that net neutrality is next on the chopping block?
Next, net neutrality is gone. I guarantee you. In 6 months, it will not exist.
And just explain briefly to the audience, because it's such a terrible term.
So net neutrality says that if you own the pipe into someone's house, if you're Comcast, you have to treat every stream of content that comes in there equally. You can't slow down the speed from some things, and you can't speed up the speed from the content you own. Once you take that off, once you get rid of net neutrality, then essentially Comcast can favor the services it owns already, whether it's NBC or CNBC or the Golf Channel, and it can degrade the quality of the streams of other people, or it can make you pay more for other people. And needless to say, if you have a data plan on your cell phone, it can make their services part of the package and make you pay extra for other people's services. And it can extract money from third parties to make the speed make you part of their data plan. So the number of nefarious things they can do once you get rid of net neutrality is astonishing.
Right, but you say 6 months. So does that mean the audience, the public, the American citizen have to wake up and fight this, and they've got 6 months to stop this?
That's exactly what needs to happen.
All right.
And it needs to happen from media outlets like yours that help people wake up to the reality of what's going on. Because I promise you, you're not hearing about this on Fox News, and you're not hearing about this on Rush Limbaugh. There's no outrage over there at any of these things.
Well, you're probably not hearing it on NBC if they're going to be a beneficiary.
You probably are not.
Right.
You're right. You are not hearing about it in NBC, because guess who's getting advantage of this?
Well,
the owner of NBC, Comcast.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, who's the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book just out is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing today's triggering of Article 50 that will begin the two-year Brexit process.
Want me off your back? Well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Grant, who is a co-founder and director of the Centre for European Reform in London. Previously, he was a correspondent for The Economist in Brussels, covering the European community, then later became defence editor of The Economist, and is author of Russia, China, and Global Governance, and How to Build a Modern European Union. He works on, among other subjects, EU foreign and defense policy, Russia, China, the euro, and global governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Grant.
Hello.
Hello, Charles. And today a letter was handed to EU Council President Donald Tusk, and it triggered Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, an occasion where Prime Minister of the UK, Theresa May, said this is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back. Now, of course, Brexit passed by a narrow margin, and there was some buyer's remorse expressed shortly thereafter. So the question would be then, given what the courts did in terms of intervening and the House being forced to take a stand, where do you think British public opinion is? It's in something that is inexorable but may not be what the majority want, or is it what the majority want?
Well, you should know where I'm coming from. I was a Remainer. I wanted to keep Britain in the EU, and I lost the argument. I disagree with your point about buyer's remorse. There's been almost no buyer's remorse. Opinion polls show that a majority of the British want to get a move on with Brexit, want to make it happen. Even those who voted Remain, many of them want to get on with the exit process. Public opinion is quite happy with the prospect of leaving the EU, mainly because the economy has done very well since the vote, against the predictions of those like me who favoured Remain. The economy has done so well. My own view would be the economy won't continue to do well for very long because the loss of foreign direct investment will, in a year or two, start to impact on growth and prosperity and productivity. But so far, the economy is doing fine. Plus, you have an onslaught of quite savage attacks by the right-wing Eurosceptic media and anybody who bothers to make the case for the EU. So the way the media shape Britain's public debate, and I'm sad to say the way the BBC follow some of the Eurosceptic media, makes it quite hard for public opinion to think afresh and say, hang on, do we want to go ahead with this? Are there problems ahead? We're all told it's going to be absolutely just fine. That's what right-wing politicians say, what the government says. It's what many influential newspapers say.
Well, I believe that Rupert Murdoch's newspapers, and they are quite powerful in influencing British public opinion, he was a big champion of Brexit. Is that what you're talking about when you say the BBC is following the rest of the herd in terms of Euroscepticism?
Yes, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. Perhaps to be fair to the BBC tries quite hard to be unbiased and to give both sides of the argument, the pro-EU side and the anti-EU side, but because traditionally, perhaps in the past, the BBC had a something of a liberal pro-EU bias. It's now constantly attacked by the Murdoch press, but actually by more influential newspapers like the Daily Mail, which is not part of the Murdoch press and has much more influence than the Murdoch press. It is attacked by Eurosceptic newspapers for being too liberal, too pro-EU. Therefore, it is leaning over backwards to prove that it's not. And the senior editors that I talk to at the BBC admit that they really are trying very, very hard not to have too many pro-EU voices on, to have a Nigel Farage of UKIP on, the leading Brexiteer, every day, virtually. So I think in the past, perhaps, the BBC may have been a little bit pro-EU, but now it's probably a bit biased the other way, but to counteract the allegation that it may be pro-EU.
But Farage, of course, is the head of UKIP, and they just lost their only member in Parliament, did they not? So how does that factor into this inexorable move towards Brexit and the change of public opinion to accept it and get on with it?
Well, UKIP was very influential, and so was Nigel Farage. It's quite charismatic leader. There would not have been a referendum on EU membership without Mr. Farage setting up this powerful party, UKIP, which made the Tory party scared they would lose votes for UKIP, and hence the Tory party offered a referendum to the British people in order to see off the threat, the challenge from UKIP. But now that UKIP has achieved its objective, which is to leave the EU, it has no purpose left in life at all, and it's falling apart and its members are killing each other, and Douglas Carswell, its one member of parliament, has resigned before he was kicked out. Nigel Farage has given up the leadership in any case. It's an awful mess, but it doesn't really matter. They won their great strategic victory of getting Britain out, and they have a new UKIP, a sort of a UKIP-similar party now called the Conservative Party, which used to be long ago pro-European, actually took Britain into the EU in 1973, but it's increasingly dominated by Eurosceptic forces. Not entirely. There are still pro-EU people in the Tory party, but it's a very UKIP-influenced party. So who needs UKIP when the Tory party itself is becoming very Eurosceptic?
So the Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty was triggered today, but it gives both sides 2 years to reach an agreement. And the UK will then officially leave on the 29th of March 2019, which is a Friday. Now, we know the European leader, Donald Tusk, said it was not a happy day. Angela Merkel has weighed in, and she's rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's call for negotiations on the UK exits, which she was hoping that would run parallel with talks that would define the future relationship. And already there's tensions over whether trade is going to be traded off against security. So, in effect, what Chancellor Merkel is saying is basically what, divorce first, then settle later? Is that what she's saying?
Yes, there is a bit of a difference here between Britain and its partners, including Germany. And I speak to you from Berlin, where I've been talking to people in the German government today. But it's not necessarily an impossible gap to bridge between the two sides. The position of the European Union is this year, 2017, is for Article 50. That's the so-called divorce negotiations. The arguments about how much money the British may or may not know the owe the EU, the rights of EU citizens living in Britain and vice versa, and the question of the Irish border, which is very complicated. That's what our partners say we should sort out this year. And then if we make progress on those dossiers this year, they say, next year we can talk about the future relationship, including trading relations and other sorts of future relationship on security. And that's the European position. Well, the British say, let's talk about both things at the same time. That's not going to be possible because the EU is going to refuse to do that. And frankly, the EU has the upper hand in this negotiation, though nobody's bothered to tell the British public opinion that yet. I think there will be, perhaps, if all goes well, a kind of compromise, which is that in 2017, this year, we'll talk about the Article 50 divorce settlement. And if the British show some goodwill and flexibility on the very thorny question of money in particular and the rights of EU citizens living in Britain, then I think our partners will perhaps towards the end of the year allow the parallel negotiations on trade to take place at the same time as the Article 50 negotiations continue. That's an optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario is that the arguments about money become very stressed and strained and acrimonious this year. And the British storm off and say, no deal, we're not going to pay you any money because our popular tabloid newspapers don't want us to pay you money. And if the talks break down over money, we'll lose valuable negotiating time. and the risk of Britain crashing out of the EU without any deal at all starts to grow. The financial markets would go into panic, and that would perhaps be some pressure on the British government to compromise.
But you mentioned a moment ago, Charles Grant, that the British attitude is to get on with it. But that's not to say that, for example, the Scottish Nationalists are not happy. I think they feel that they basically had that referendum. Then, to some extent, they got stabbed in the back by Brexit. And now they're calling for another referendum. And Northern Ireland is deadlocked. Wales is apparently, at least according to Alex Salmond, the Scottish Nationalist Party's foreign affairs spokesman, I'll just give you the full quote. After nine months of his prime minister's approach to Brexit, Northern Ireland is deadlocked. The Welsh are alienated. Scotland is going for a referendum. And Britain and the English are split down the middle. And Brexit MPs are walking out of Commons committees because they don't like home truths. So it's not as if things are all peace and love on the home front, right?
No, that's true. I think Alex Salmond is a fine polemicist, but he exaggerates a little. For a start, there isn't really a problem in Wales because the Welsh, like the English, voted to leave the EU, and most people in Wales are quite happy to leave the EU, with a few exceptions, of course. In Ireland, there is a lot of instability, much of it not caused by Brexit, but caused by a scandal in the Irish government, which has tied up or affected some of the ruling Democratic Unionist Party. It is true that Brexit has destabilised things a bit. The majority of Northern Ireland wanted to stay in the UK, and the scandal has increased the vote in the recent general election for the Republicans, who are pro-union with the South and pro-staying in the EU. So there is certainly a bit of instability in Northern Ireland, though it's not all caused by Brexit. The real argument that Salmond makes, which has some potency, is that about Scotland. I'm a member of Nicola Sturgeon's Advisory Council, a non-aligned group. I don't support Scottish independence, but I'm with a group of people who advise her on European issues, and I was with the council in Glasgow and Mrs. Sturgeon on Monday of this week. And I think whatever you think about the rights and wrongs of membership, of independence rather, I would say that the way Mrs. May is handling Brexit appears to be strengthening the case for independence in Scotland, because the Scottish people feel they're not being consulted very much over the kind of deal that Mrs. May is going to seek in Europe. They weren't even told in advance the day that Mrs. May would activate Article 50. They believe, rightly I think, that Britain is heading for a hard Brexit, meaning a Brexit with relatively few links remaining between the British Isles and the European continent, and that a hard Brexit is damaging to the Scottish economy. So on the one hand, the economic case for Scottish independence is frankly diminished with Britain outside the EU, because if Scotland breaks away from Britain, when Britain remains its biggest market by a very long way, a much bigger market than the rest of the EU, it would be quite damaging to the Scottish economy, especially since Scotland receives about £10 billion a year of subsidy from the British taxpayer, and especially when the oil price in Scotland has some oil is very low. So economically, to be honest, independence doesn't really make sense for Scotland, but that doesn't mean that Scotland won't vote for independence, because as we've learned this year, certainly with the Brexit referendum last year, economics doesn't always come to the forefront when people make big decisions. And against the economic argument is the kind of sovereignty argument and the national identity argument. And the fact that the London government is seen as controlled by right-wing, Eurosceptic English Conservatives, who are not popular in Scotland, gives Mrs. Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, extra reasons to campaign for independence. So my own guess would be there will be another referendum on Scottish independence just after Britain leaves the EU, perhaps in 2019, and at this time round, at the second attempt, the chances of the Scottish voting for independence are a little higher than they were last time, and last time the independence movement got 45% of the vote.
Well, just in closing, Charles Grant, here in the United States, of course, the Democratic Party is in the distinct minority as the Republicans enact an aggressive agenda, even though the president himself is under daily siege. Then, nevertheless, he's distracting everybody from a lot of aggressive moves going on the part of the Republicans, who are very much in ascendancy both at the state and federal level. level. So that there's a kind of, you know, dark night of the soul going on with the Democrats. How are we going to get back into power to stop this? And I assume the same thing's happening with Labour in the UK. Is there any path forward for Labour to ever get back into the majority?
Well, I think Labour is in a worse mess than the Democrats. After all, in your recent presidential election in your country, the Democrats won the popular vote. They didn't do disastrously. They got, you know, roughly as many votes as the Republicans got. While the Labour Party, if you look at the latest opinion polls in Britain, is scoring 20-something percent, while the Conservative Party is scoring something like 40% or more. The ratings of the leaders, Mrs. May scores roughly 50% approval rating, which is quite high for a British politician. Jeremy Corbyn, the hard left Labour leader, scores about 19 or 18%. So Labour is in a hell of a mess. It'll take some time to describe why, but very briefly, firstly, it's kind of disappeared in Scotland. In Scotland, the Scottish Nationalist Party has become the main party of working people and middle-class people against the old-fashioned Conservative Party, which does exist in Scotland, but is seen as the party of business. So the SNP, the Nationalists, have replaced Labour in Scotland as the dominant party. Labour for a long time ran Scotland. In the north of England and the Midlands, Labour is in danger of losing its traditional working-class vote. Some of them have gone to UKIP, the English Nationalist Party, some to the Conservatives, some are just abstaining or not bothering to vote at all. But these people think that Labour is too soft on the issue of migration, and because they don't, a lot of working-class voters don't like migration, they have turned against the Labour Party. Meanwhile, in London and the South East and the university towns, where Labour's traditional voters are middle-class, they are risking drifting away from Labour because they think Labour's not pro-EU enough. Since Britain voted to leave the EU in the referendum 8 months ago, the Labour leadership has been quite, although it's regressed the moving out of the EU, it's been in favour of restricting migration from EU countries. It's opposed a kind of hardline opposition to leaving the EU. It's tried to accommodate the government, which upsets the very pro-EU voters in the big towns and cities and the university towns. So these voters are drifting away to the Liberal Party, a centrist party, though not so much as the working-class voters are drifting away in the north of England. So if you like a metaphor, the Labour Party is like a pantomime horse. It's always had two halves to it. One half was the metropolitan liberal middle class. The other half was the traditional working-class voters in the north and the Midlands and South Wales. And the two parts of the pantomime horse were stuck together for a long time because they had enough in common to get on. But now that you have this issue of migration has become so sensitive, the urban middle classes think migration is okay, and the traditional working classes are against it. So it's created a kind of a big split in the Labour Party. And whether any leader, whoever replaces Jeremy Corbyn, is able to unite the party again, give it a vision, give it a strong set of policies is very, very debatable. And I think the Tory party, the ruling Conservative Party, believes it's now running what is virtually a one-party state. And this matters for Brexit, because if there's no opposition, and there isn't really an opposition, except in Scotland where the Nationalists are the opposition, if there's no opposition in Britain, then the government can do what it likes on Brexit. It's one reason why we're heading for a very hard Brexit, although there's no majority in the country as a whole for Brexit. Most people in the country probably would favour a soft Brexit, even if they favour Brexit. But we're going to get a very hard Brexit with few economic and other ties to the continent of Europe, and that's partly because we have no opposition, because Labour is in a dreadful mess, much more of a mess, I would hazard to say, than your Democrats are in the US.
Well, Charles Grant, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Not at all. Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Grant, who's a co-founder and director of the Centre for European Reform in London. He previously was a correspondent for The Economist in Brussels, covering the European community, then later became defence editor of The Economist and is the author of Russia, China and Global Governance and How to Build a Modern European Union. He works on, among other subjects, EU foreign and defence policy, Russia, China, the euro and global governance. We're going to take a brief station break. We look into the tightening of the siege of Raqqa and Mosul and look into the increase in civilian casualties. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rahed Jarrah, who's the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. military assistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rahed Jarrah.
Thank you again for having me.
And, Rahed, the Pope is demanding urgent action to protect civilians in Iraq following reports of severe numbers of civilian casualties in Mosul. And what's your understanding, since I think you have a lot of contacts with your former country, is there any sense that these casualties are caused? I mean, the questions now are, is this from American airstrikes or coalition airstrikes, or is this from ISIS, or is it a combination of both in terms of these large numbers of civilian casualties?
That's why I think it's the current calls for an investigation are really important. We heard a few international organizations, including the UN and Amnesty International, calling for an investigation into what happened. And the investigation is important because it sounds like the U.S. military has changed its rules of engagement lately. And that has led to increasing civilian casualties. And this is extremely concerning because one of the main principles of international humanitarian law, the law of war, is proportionality and distinction. So what the U.S. is doing now is that the U.S. has changed its rules of engagement to allow for more civilians to fall during these attacks. And we need more information about how that happened, who authorized it, and whether the current changes might constitute violations of international law. These might be war crimes when the U.S. bombs one location and kills hundreds of civilians. This might constitute a war crime because of the level of civilian casualties. So that's the first point that I want to make. The other one is that we should also keep in mind that there are thousands of other civilians who were killed in Mosul and around Iraq by the Iraqi security forces and militias affiliated with the Iraqi security forces. And those forces also receive U.S. military aid and training and U.S. weapons. And the U.S. is, according to U.S. law and international law, responsible for some of those crimes committed by the Iraqi forces. So according to some Iraqi human rights organizations, there are over 3,000 civilians who were killed in Mosul alone in the last few weeks. We're talking about more civilians killed in Mosul in the last few weeks than civilians killed in the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. This is a disastrous attack on a city that is being conducted either by direct U.S. military intervention or indirect U.S. support by arming and equipping and aiding these Iraqi forces. So we're talking about thousands of civilians who were killed, and we really need to look into these violations seriously and investigate them.
And what responsibility would you place on the Islamic State or Daesh, since they are pretty suicidal and pretty ruthless?
Correct. I mean, I think the situation that we're dealing with requires an investigation to see what the U.S. and Iraqi forces and other militias, including ISIS, have committed of crimes. Of course, you know, for us as U.S. citizens and people who live in the U.S., we don't really have that much leverage over ISIS to investigate ISIS crimes, you know. We should look into those, and I think many of the crimes of ISIS have been widely covered by U.S. and international media. But we should also look at the crimes of our own tax dollars and what the U.S. is doing there directly and indirectly. So, of course, you know, once a commission looks into these violations and possibilities for war crimes, they have to look into possibilities of war crimes committed by all parties, including non-state parties such as ISIS and other armed groups in Mosul. But the point at hand here is that we really have to investigate what's going on from the U.S. side, because that is getting less coverage and it's getting less attention than the crimes committed by armed groups such as ISIS.
Well, there's no secret that in his election campaign, Donald Trump pledged to target the Islamic State more aggressively. And he criticized Obama's and the coalition's air campaign as being too gentle. And Amnesty International is reporting that the rising civilian death toll suggests to them that the U.S.-led coalition has changed its posture of late and it's not taking adequate precautions to help Iraqi's forces retake the city without causing civilian casualties. Now, the U.S. has denied any loosening of the rules of combat, but it seems an awfully coincidental, doesn't it, that Donald Trump says, let's take the gloves off, we got to get tough, you know, and he's given to these kind of macho outbursts, and he said he knows more than the generals do, to God knows what kind of orders are coming out of the White House. But it's hard not to notice a coincidence that Donald Trump has said he wants to get tougher and take the gloves off, and now it appears to be happening, or at least there's been an uptick in civilian casualties. So is that a coincidence?
I don't think it's a coincidence, because we've seen a pattern of attacks with very high civilian casualties in both Iraq and Syria. The U.S. just attacked a mosque in Syria a couple weeks ago, killing scores of civilians who were in the mosque as well. So I think, you know, like with the situation with the Muslim ban that President Trump promised and then tried to implement, this seems to be another situation where the administration's intentions to take the gloves off and be extremely tough and kill civilians are happening now. And that's why I think many organizations would like to see an investigation. Not many people trust President Trump's words now by saying that the rules have not changed, because it seems like there was an intention to change them, and it seems like there are actions now that suggest that the rules have changed. So I really think that the only way forward is to look into what's going on and investigate what kind of orders have been given by the White House to the military, and if these rules have changed in a way to get us to this point where the U.S. might be committing war crimes on a daily basis because of the number of civilians who are killed. I think people have to be held accountable. These are not only words coming out of the campaign rhetoric or a speech anymore. These are bombs falling on people's homes.
So you mentioned the attack on the mosque, or the bombing of the mosque, and then, of course, the U.S. military said that it was an al-Qaeda meeting that was taking place. But there were civilian casualties, and apparently there's an investigation going on. But if the same situation exists, does it not, in the sense that the Syrian city of Raqqa, which is the capital for the Islamic State or Daesh, that is pretty much surrounded, as is Mosul. And there's also concerns about a major dam nearby that could be breached. So what's your understanding of whether the situation in Raqqa is going to get as bad as what's happening now in Mosul?
It seems like it's going on the same path. There are many parallels to what's going on in Raqqa and Mosul to what happened in other cities in the past. I mentioned a report by Human Rights Watch that came out last year. It's called After Liberation Came Destruction. And the report discusses how the Iraqi forces, aided by the U.S., committed violations, including war crimes, after taking cities back from ISIS. These include ethnic cleansing, sectarian cleansing of these cities, destruction of private properties, etc. There were also mass violations like executions, rape, torture that were committed by Iraqi forces there. So, unfortunately, we are seeing similar patterns now on a bigger scale around Mosul, and many people anticipate that the same patterns will happen around Raqqa. The issue of the dam that you mentioned, Al-Tabaqa Dam next to Raqqa, is very similar to the issue of the Mosul Dam. Both dams are in a bad construction, bad structural situation. If either of them were to collapse, we're talking about a humanitarian catastrophe that would affect the lives of millions of people. So there are many parallels there with the political context and the military context of what's going on and the humanitarian threats. And I think there are also parallels to the theme that the U.S. and its allies in the region are trying to combat extremism and terrorism by dropping more bombs. This is a theme that has been going on for now over a decade in Iraq. It has not worked, dropping more bombs on extremist groups in Fallujah and Mosul and Baghdad and Najaf and Karbala. Has not worked. You know, the U.S. has not been successful in bombing Iraq into moderation and stability, and I doubt that it will work now in Iraq or in Syria. So it's not only about, you know, the details of what's going on, it's also about the larger picture. I think the U.S. and its allies are illusioned. They're living an illusion of fixing the situation in Iraq and Syria by dropping more bombs. There has to be a more comprehensive plan that takes into account socio-political solutions.
Well, the Syrian government, the Assad regime, just worked out a deal, I think it was with al-Nusra, where they swapped the civilian populations of some Shia towns that had been under siege by, I think, al-Nusra, or one of the many militias. I mean, there's something like 1,500 militias there, so it's hard to keep track. But the point I wanted to make was that it seems like the government of Syria and some of the rebel groups seem to be able to make deals, in this case, swapping besieged populations. But is it the case that you can't make a deal with the Islamic State, that they just are too fanatical?
Yeah, like, you know, the debate about having some sort of negotiated resolution to the situation in Iraq and Syria, it includes, you know, thinking about it as an onion, you know, like not necessarily engaging with ISIS directly as a first step. There are so many groups around ISIS who are more willing to negotiate, who are more reasonable, who are not affiliated directly with ISIS. And I think peeling them off is very easy by creating a clear path to a negotiated settlement. In Iraq, the majority of forces in Mosul and around were not affiliated with ISIS a couple of years ago. They're either forces who are opposed to the Iraqi government because they think it's very sectarian, or forces who are willing to coordinate with ISIS because they see ISIS as the lesser of two evils, believe it or not. So if there was a space bring these groups back to the table, you know, many of them were participating in the Iraqi parliament. You know, these are nationalist Iraqi groups who are not as extremist or violent as ISIS. So that at least, you know, that is one step towards a negotiated settlement that precedes any talks about engaging ISIS directly with the talk. Where we stand now, we're not even close to any negotiated settlements with any of these groups. Unfortunately, the U.S. and its allies have failed to incorporate such talks as a part of ending violence in Iraq, and rather there is almost 100% reliance on military action without taking in consideration political and social solutions.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Riot, the Washington Post is reporting that people in Syria have normally been terrified of Russian planes and also the regime, the Assad regime planes, because, you know, they dropped these barrel bombs on civilian targets. But apparently, according to this report from the Washington Post, their person on the ground there is that, and this also is true in Mosul as well, apparently, that now the civilians in both Mosul and Iraq are now afraid of American airstrikes. So has that happened? Is that your understanding, since you've got pretty good contacts in Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, with this, what seems to be a changing attitude of the U.S. presence, the U.S. is becoming yet another source of mass destruction and death in Iraq and Syria. As you mentioned, many civilians looked at, you know, Assad regime or the Iraqi central government or Russian strikes as being extremely violent and causing the death of many civilians in each of the attacks. Now the U.S. is being added to that list of shame of militias and dictators in the region who kill civilians right and left with no restrictions. Unfortunately, now the U.S. is yet just one other force to be added to this, to the list of these murderous groups that might kill you and your family while you're sleeping. So it's really shameful to see how the Trump administration is pushing this new policy in Iraq and Syria that makes the U.S. Another part of the problem rather than trying to be a part of the solution.
Well, Riad Giarrara, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Riad Giarrara, who is the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written